From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Anyone who has hosted a meal in recent years, whether a big holiday gathering for extended family or a casual summer supper al fresco for friends, has faced the moment of reckoning or even panic when various guests reveal their dietary restrictions or philosophies. One's a vegan, another has food allergies, another doesn't consider it dinner without a major piece of meat in the center of the plate. Can we all sit down and have dinner together, asks Anna Thomas, and then she answers that question with a resounding yes in her just-out cookbook, Vegan, Vegetarian, Omnivore, Dinner for Everyone at the Table. No more food fights, bring on the togetherness, and without exhausting the cook either. Anna Thomas is author of the 1973 million-seller cookbook, The Vegetarian Epicure, and also of Love Soup in 2009, one of my most used cookbooks ever, and which won a James Beard Award, so I'm not alone in my praise. She's here today to get us rethinking how we cook for the social table, and also to share innovative salads and inspired dressings in time for planting some of the key ingredients for them in our gardens. Welcome, Anna, to Away to Garden. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thank
Good.
You.
Glad to speak to you, and so glad to get the new book. I was ready for another Anna Thomas cookbook, so.
Oh, thanks. That's
yes.
So nice.
Yes, yes. So before we get to talking salads and specifics, I want to briefly discuss kind of the book's point of view. You say in it that, you know, we're often sort of starting backwards when we try to accommodate everyone at the table, kind of bending over backwards and responding
yeah.
to what, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is really a book about hospitality and about community. And everybody wants that, you know. And so that's why we do bend over backwards. But, you know, we want that. We want to all sit down at the table together and have a good time. But people started telling me that they were afraid of, you know, to invite people over to eat. They were afraid to have a dinner party. People would start to panic, and boy, believe me, around Thanksgiving, and you know,
right.
this would reach critical mass, but all the time. And I thought, no, this is not a good thing. This is not good, because sitting down to eat together, to me, that is not a detail of civilized life. You know, that's kind of the basis of it.
Right.
And we don't want to give that up. You know,
no.
We don't want to throw that away just because people eat a little bit differently. And what I thought about when I thought about this was, well, we do grow up in a meat-centric culture, food culture, you know. And so we want to make a flexible meal that we can have different people over. But we're starting with that idea of a piece of meat in the center and a couple of things around the sides. And if you start there, inevitably you will be substituting and compromising right away if you want to accommodate other people than that meat eater, you know. And I thought, well, you know, that's difficult. The other option is making two meals, you know.
Right.
Well,
right.
First of all, a gigantic hassle, if you know what I mean. And secondly, you know, if there are two meals, you know, let's face it, there's always going to be an A meal and a B meal.
I loved that in the book where you said that, and I you know, I've been a vegetarian for 40 years, and I've eaten a lot of B meals at public events and so forth.
It's true, right? You
right.
know, I go, well, we have this alternate meal for you. You know, I go, wait a minute, you know?
Yeah.
I want to be on the A list, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a problem, and nobody wants to be eating the B meal. I don't, you don't. Nobody does, you know. So I thought, well, what do we have to do here? And that's when the idea sort of came to me that we have to invert our thinking, turn it on its head, because we're not just bending over backwards to have people over to eat with us. We're doing it backwards. If we start with the food everyone eats and then elaborate, don't stop there, elaborate, keep going. But if you start with the food everyone eats, And whether you're thinking of a single dish or a whole menu, a big meal, whatever it is, start with that food. Figure something out that's delicious, that's satisfying, that's lovely, that everybody will like, and then don't stop there. You know,
right.
honor everybody who's at your table and figure out the right dairy products, the right cheese, the right, you know, piece of fish or meat or whatever it is that works with that meal, and think of it more as an accessory.
Right.
And that's what I did. And I thought, you know, this way, everybody's eating pretty much the same meal, some version of it.
Yes.
Nobody feels sidelined.
Yes.
You know?
And so, in other words, we're not starting, if we're the hostess, we're not starting planning our menu thinking about, oh, he doesn't eat this, she doesn't eat that, and making a list of what people don't eat.
No.
We're starting by thinking of what brings us all together that we all eat.
Yeah. Because there are millions of foods that we all eat.
Yeah.
I mean, you stop and think about it. You know, when people apply labels and they say something like vegan, a lot of people back away right away because they think that's some weird kind of food that they don't eat. But in fact, that's the food everybody eats. You go to a picnic, you eat the watermelon. It's not the vegan watermelon. It's just the watermelon. Everybody eats it. You go to the bar at happy hour, have your margarita, you have your guacamole and your chips. They're not the vegan guacamole and chips. They're just the guacamole and chips that everybody eats.
Right.
Et cetera.
So the book has like 150 recipes with this philosophy, and it has menus ranging from like mezze parties to Thanksgiving or other holiday dinners to a whole salad supper or pizza nights. And I mean, lots of different. So this problem, you're not solving this problem just for like the high holidays, so to speak, but also for everyday cooking, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the holidays, in a funny kind of way, are almost the easiest thing to deal with because we make big meals with lots of dishes.
Right.
So we can deal with it in a menu. What if you're just having a couple of people over for dinner and you want to make, you know, one or two things and that's it? You want to make a simple meal. That's where things like, well, my fish soup that I make a lot. It is not a fish soup until 2 minutes before people eat it.
Exactly.
It's a vegetable soup. It's
exactly.
A beautiful, delicious vegetable soup that you can garnish in many different ways. And you can divide it between two pots and add the seafood to one of those pots 5 minutes before you're serving it. And you can have two different versions and everybody's happy and it's delicious. And, you know, those kind of approaches to things that take a little advanced thinking,
right.
You know, and I've done it for you.
So before we move on to like the salads and so forth and some specific examples of how this all works, I have to say that I got lost in the dessert chapter. Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
There's like coconut rice pudding with cardamom. Oh, my goodness. And ginger snap topping for a winter fruit crumble. Like these little differences, you know, taking something I've heard of before and these little differences in the flavor to just make it a little more special. Ooh. Those look pretty good.
I love those desserts. I do. I love them. But I have to say that my goal here was, as in every part of the book, was really to come up with as many things as possible that were just delicious and wonderful, but that were not dairy-based.
Right.
And so that you could have a dessert, and then very often you could sort of pair it with something else, like you could have that crumble that you just talked about, which I love,
right?
With the gingerbread topping, and you could have a scoop of vanilla ice cream next to it, or not,
or
you
not,
don't have
right?
To, you know,
and the rice
and,
pudding I think was almond milk and coconut milk combined the milk,
and they just happened to work fantastically with those flavors, you know,
right?
So that was kind of a no-brainer.
So let's talk about salads. And one observation I would make about the range of salads in the new book, whether the sort of main course ones or the ones you call companion salads, is that they're sort of, it's the genius of them. And obviously I haven't made them all and tasted them all yet, but I'm like imagining in my mind's mouth as I'm reading.
Yeah, you will make them all.
Right. So I'm imagining. So the genius of them is that it's not just the flavor combinations, you know, the ingredients, but there's also a range of textures, and I really was struck by that. And I wanted to talk about a little bit of that. Like, you have that finely chopped holiday salad that you make, and then you have others that have shaved ingredients. And so let's talk about texture a little bit, how important that is in when you cook, how you approach that.
Well, I think it really changes how things taste.
Yeah.
If you cut off, for example, if you have a beautiful piece of fennel, a nice fennel bulb, and you cut a big chunk of it off and just bite into that and eat that. It's crunchy. It's delicious. It's very kind of strong and forward, you know. But if you shave it into thin, thin, thin slices, the slices that are translucent that you can see through, that you use your mandolin to shave, suddenly you get a very delicate piece of fennel, and also it absorbs much more of the, you know, the sort of citrusy dressing that's on it.
Right.
And so it's a very different experience right away. And chopped salads, you know, I love chopped salads. I am a chopped salad fanatic, and I order them in restaurants, and I make them, and I make all kinds of chopped salads because I love that experience of getting like a whole bunch of different little flavors and textures all sort of exploding in your mouth at the same time, you know?
Well, yeah, so, definitely. It definitely struck me that you think, as you create recipes, that you're thinking texture, not just flavors, but also the texture is super important.
Well, it's part of the fun, you know? It's part of the fun of eating.
Yeah.
That you get to do these things.
Yeah, and there were, with flavors, there were things that I hadn't thought of. And for gardeners, these are, you know, just some, it's like ideas that are so easy to bring from the garden. Like, there's a parsley and radish salad that has all kinds of surprise ingredients in it. And, you know, I always put parsley, flat Italian parsley leaves in my salad greens, you know, as like one of the leaves in my salads.
Yeah.
But I've never made where parsley is the main green. So this one has like parsley, radishes, what, like dried cranberries?
I did. Does it have, remind me, I don't have the book open.
Yeah, I think
that.
It has dried.
Does it have a little radicchio maybe?
It has,
exactly. Like that?
It has like the redness of radicchio and dried cranberries and celery and salty capers.
Yeah.
And so it's like, wow. I mean, so
surprising.
Well,
you know, that salad was the answer to a question that, for me, that was like, what do you do in the winter? When you don't have those, you know, beautiful, it's not spring yet, you don't have those beautiful lettuces that you want, you don't have the kind of things that do so well with a little more sun, a little more warmth.
Right.
But that Italian parsley, the flat leaf Italian parsley, I was getting gigantic bunches of it in my farmer's market, and the leaves were big and you know, sort of crisp and formidable, and you know, and I thought, wow, you look like you're auditioning to be a salad, let's go, you know?
Right. So to me, that was very inspired, because that is something that's available for a longer season, and it's so good for you. I mean, my goodness, could you get more greenness, you know, in anything?
Oh, but it's so delicious.
Yeah,
it's just so good. Why should it be relegated to be a sort of a garnish or a little dressing for something.
Right, right. So let's go from there, you know, talking back again for a minute about texture. Yes. You have this sort of, you have this chopped salad, I guess that's kale. Now, how do you wrangle kale? A lot of people are freaked out when they get kale. They're like, oh my God, it's so like dirt, it's so tough or whatever.
It's a warrior. That's why it was used. So for so many years, you would only see kale really sitting in that bed of ice on commercial salad bars, where it was surrounding all the plates, you know, because it would last for days.
It's a garden. It was a decor item.
A decor item. But I love kale, and I use kale in a lot of different ways. And what I found was, to make a really good kale salad, it's actually really easy. The only thing you really need to do is you just need to break that kale down a little bit in the right way. And so what I do is I take my, you know, either my Tuscan kale or my curly kale, I cut it up in thin strips, and kind of, not exactly shreds, but, you know, thin slices, thin strips. And I have that in a bowl, and I pour my very lemony dressing over it. It needs a little salt and a little acid from the lemon.
Okay.
And then I pretend that it is a ball of bread dough, and I just knead it with my hands for about a minute. That's it.
Oh, my goodness.
That's honestly what I do.
Okay.
just put my hands in there, and I just sort of mush it up and knead it like it's bread dough. And that works the salt and the acid into the kale, and it breaks it down a little bit. And it sort of like, I think to myself, I'm making kale ceviche, you know, I'm breaking it down with the acid.
Interesting.
And once you do that, it becomes sort of supple, and and not it's not so kind of, it doesn't have that I am a piece of raw kale, I dare you bite into me quality, you know. And the dressing I found that was really perfect for that was one that I developed really for that purpose has a lot of lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
It has like almost twice as much lemon juice as it has olive oil.
Oh.
And because it has so much lemon juice, I realized I needed to balance that acid with something, so I added a little bit of agave nectar to it. And that was so delicious. The simplest dressing in the world. Lemon juice, olive oil, a little bit of agave nectar, and some sea salt. That's it.
And I saw throughout the book, that's so great that you bring that up, because the agave nectar was one of your sort of not-so-secret ingredients that appears in quite a number of your dressings. So that kind of offsets the, you love citrus, you know, juices and zests and so forth, but this offsets it, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, agave, it is a sugar, but it's a sugar that's very delicate. It's a nectar, so you don't have to dissolve it.
Yeah.
You can use a little bit of it, and you get a lot of oomph out of a little bit of it. And it has that, it's not as assertive in flavor as perhaps honey or maple syrup or something like
that. I completely agree, but I haven't used it in salad dressing. So that was a real aha to me. I was like, oh, I need to try that
it's delicious.
Yeah.
It really is good. And when you make this dressing and work your kale with it, just like a minute, literally, we're not talking a long time here, then you have a canvas pretty much for anything.
Right.
The summer chopped salad that you were referring to has fresh corn and peppers and tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, and, you know, a lot of fresh herbs. It's got mint and basil and, you know, just delicious things. I mean, it's so good. But you can certainly do that with, you can do a salad like that with all sorts of things. You can add roasted root vegetables to that kale.
Right.
You can add, you know, depending what the season is,
right,
you can add radishes and you can add a lot of different things. And you get just this, you start to run with that and you get these beautiful chopped salads. They're just so, they're so nice. And really, if you think about it, a very substantial salad like that is what I call a center of the plate salad.
Right.
That's not a side salad, you
right.
know? And especially if you add one of the grains that I love to use, or a legume, but I love to use farro. I love to mix farro and black rice. I like to use red quinoa. You add a little bit of a grain like that to a salad like this, and you've got what really is a one-dish meal.
So,
can you add things? Yes, you can. You can.
So you might also have, for that meathead who's at the table.
and we love our meatheads.
I know.
And we want them to feel good at our table. So, yes, you can have something really easy like that rotisserie chicken that you picked up on your way home from work. Or you can have, I love to have a pan-grilled swordfish with garlic. That's a very, very easy thing to do. And kale is a strong flavor, you know, so you can meet a strong flavor with another strong flavor.
Right.
And it's wonderful. Not to mention all kinds of terrific cheeses, like a Maytag blue cheese, I think, is recommended in the book as something that could go with this. So, yeah, there are a lot of options.
So let's go through some more. You just mentioned grains, and you said farro, for instance. Quinoa is another possibility, is it? To make a salad into something more?
Quinoa. Mm-hmm. I love quinoa. I love red quinoa especially. I don't know why. To me, it tastes just a little more interesting, you know?
Right.
And it's delicious, and it's a very, very good source of protein. So it's one of those things, and it cooks in like 15 minutes, you know?
Right.
How user-friendly. So sometimes I just cook up some quinoa and keep it in a little container in the refrigerator and just spoon some into a tossed salad that I'm making for myself. Or one of my favorite things to do is to make the farro and black rice pilaf that I have a recipe for. And that in itself can be the beginning of a meal, the idea at the center of a meal. That farro and black rice pilaf has caramelized onion, my probably my number one not so secret ingredient.
Well, and I was going to say, you took the words right out of my mouth, because that was the other thing that I saw. It was like a little bit of a motif, and it shows up, and I don't think of making them and using them as an ingredient in enough things. It changes everything. They're so rich.
I'm Polish, so I think that's maybe a Polish thing. I don't know, but like. That's what I've always done, and I see my son doing it now. It's like he thinks, well, I'm going to cook something. Let's see. So the first thing he does is cut up an onion and put it in the pan and start that sauteing and caramelizing. And then he says, okay, so now let's see. What am I going to do? What am I going to cook?
Right.
Got that first step going already.
So we have maybe, 2.5-3 minutes, and I want to just go back to dressings for a minute, some ideas, because there are some great ones in here, and I feel like, people are probably embarrassed, loath to buy bottled dressings anymore, but they're probably also still a little paralyzed about how to go beyond the basic vinaigrette. So, like, there's one that has cranberries in it, for instance, a vinaigrette with cranberries, and there's some other. So tell me a few of your variations.
Well, I love, the cranberry one. That was interesting because I was at my cousin's house in Washington, D.C. one Thanksgiving, and we were making dinner, and somebody pointed at me and said, you make the salad here, do something, put this together, make a dressing. And I looked, and there were all these cranberries sitting around. And I was just making, I think I was just making one of my basic, lemon and olive oil and agave things that I was describing. And I thought, why not? And I just threw a handful of cranberries, raw cranberries, into the blender with that. It was delicious. It was just so good. And so you sort of use what speaks to you, what's in front of you. But I love ginger. So I have a fresh ginger and citrus dressing that I really, really like. And with ginger, that little drop of dark sesame oil and a little bit of rice vinegar is fantastic. It really makes it makes it pop. And, I also like miso. Mm. And using a little bit of fresh miso, I think I have one here with red miso and a little tamari, not too much.
Right.
And again, a little mirin and sesame oil. These are not crazy ingredients. They're pretty easy to find everywhere. And this is where your blender shines. You just put all those things in the blender. 20 seconds later, you have a lovely dressing.
Right, and it really changes everything, and it puts your signature on it and makes it special. And I guess that's sort of the whole book is kind of about building these special meals that bring people together, and yet not complicated. Special without complicated, I think.
I'm a home cook.
Yeah.
I'm not a chef. I don't have a restaurant. I'm a home cook.
Yeah.
And so everything I cook has to be pretty accessible. And really, there are some things that are a little more elaborate in here, but most of it is very, very straightforward. And it just really starts with that idea of starting with the food everybody eats, coming up with something that's very delicious and satisfying, but that can be accessorized and elaborated, because I want everybody to be happy at my table. I want everybody to feel honored.
Well, I'm happy with the cookbook, and it's Vegan, Vegetarian, Omnivore, Dinner for Everyone at the Table from Anna Thomas. Thank you so much. And, of course, I'll have a book giveaway and all kinds of good things, and I'll have some recipes along with the transcript. I'm so glad to speak to you. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. Talk to you soon again. And I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, I hope. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. So plant those special ingredients for some great salads in the garden.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.